Blog Talk Radio.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org. Hi there. Welcome aboard. This is No Misunderstanding. This is Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com, where America, in fact, always wins. This is the Wednesday, August 6th edition of Radio Free America, where the number, as always, is 718-305-7176. Very glad to speak with you tonight. Now, we actually have a very interesting and I think a very, very compelling lineup this evening. In a few minutes, I'm going to be joined by Kevin Wade. As you may recall, Kevin has been a fairly regular guest on this program for a couple of different reasons. One of them is that in Delaware, he's about my best friend. However, Kevin is now, again, running for the United States Senate in Delaware. 2 years ago, Kevin went up against a guy named Tom Carper, whose name has been synonymous with Delaware politics for over 35 years. He had never lost an election in that time. So I'm not sure anyone really expected Kevin to unseat Senator Tom Carper, who had previously been the congressman from Delaware, lieutenant governor of Delaware, the governor of Delaware, treasurer of, guys all over the place. And he's a very nice, old, career government, liberal legislator and executive. That's basically what the guy is. Nice old guy. I know him. If you're from Delaware, the chances are very good you know Tom Carper, and the chances are good you've probably known him for quite a long time. All right, now, flash forward to today. You may recall earlier this month, or earlier last month, rather, Kevin announced on this very program that he was running again for the U.S. Senate, this time against a guy who is the most liberal senator in the U.S. Senate. Guy named Chris Coons. He describes himself, and joyfully, apparently, he's happy to describe himself as the most progressive U.S. senator. I got to be honest with you, for me, that's sort of like a turnoff. I just don't hold with progressives, progressivism, or anything of that nature. Looks like Lady Michelle and Christian are in the chat room. Hey, gang. Christian, I would love to hear from you starting sometime after 8:30. Kevin Wade will be calling in shortly. So always happy to hear from our international correspondent in Denmark. I posted something on Christian's Facebook page a couple of days ago. We'll talk about that. In the meantime, Kevin, a little over a week ago, just basically up and left, right after the start, a couple of weeks after the start of a political campaign, Kevin up and left. Where did he go, you ask? Well, Kevin went into the combat zone. He went to the Israeli-Gaza border, where Kevin was essentially embedded with IDF troops. I've got the pictures to prove it. He's going to be here in a couple of minutes to actually describe what he did see over there. And the photos are extremely compelling. There is a video. Kevin was in a convoy heading back to Ben-Gurion Airport from the actual combat area. I guess all of Israel is sort of a combat area. There is a segment of it sort of on a line east and west between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and kind of anywhere north of there, they are out of Hamas missile and rocket range, but anywhere south of there, they are in range for Hamas missiles. And Hamas has launched thousands upon thousands of missiles at Israel. At least 4,000 of them during the last 10 or 12 years. I think that I saw somewhere somebody counted on either Facebook or, you know, somewhere on the internet that during the ceasefires alone, and I believe there have been four of them since this conflict really sort of heated up in the second week of July, during the ceasefires alone, almost 1,000 rockets and missiles have been launched from Gaza into Israel. So when Hamas asks for a ceasefire, what they actually are doing, especially when they put the word humanitarian in front of it, actually are doing is they are simply looking for a period of time in which they can regroup, rearm, redeploy, and prepare to attack again. They've been doing this now for well over a decade. And if you look at the Hamas charter, you will see that almost, the majority of the clauses, the covenants, declarations in the Hamas charter are based on how much they hate the Jews. I mean, look, there's got to come a time when you can just break the language barrier. And the fact of the matter is Hamas, like virtually all Mohammedans, as far as I know, absolutely despises Jewish people. They despise the state of Israel. They just absolutely hate anything that has to do with Israel, Israeli democracy, the faith of Judaism. That's what they're all about. They have received more than enough aid from the UN, the U.S., from Israel to turn the Gaza Strip into a place where could be one of the most beautiful beach resorts in the world, because that portion of the Mediterranean is, it's obviously gorgeous. There's no question about it. They could be educating their own people in science, in technology, in leadership. They could be doing all of those things, but instead they are using every penny they get their hands on to buy rockets from places like Russia, North Korea, Iran, places like that, and to fire these rockets into Israel indiscriminately. They're not like a V2 that when the Nazis would fire one of those, they were very, very certain, and history bears this out, that the V2 would land somewhere in London. That's not even what the Hamas terrorists are doing. What they are doing is they are just generally aiming them somewhere towards Israel and firing them, and I guess hoping that the Israelis are impacted by it, which, you know, they are. Sometimes they kill civilians, sometimes they go into buildings, sometimes they kill Israeli children, sometimes they kill Israeli soldiers. And after the kidnapping incident in Israel, which took place in June, it involved, I think, four Israeli teenage boys. One of them was an American, dual American citizen. Hamas terrorists kidnapped them, killed them, and the Israelis, I guess, under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, at that point, they just figured that they had had enough. And they did. So they decided they were going to take the action necessary to defend their country. There are two things that can be done to blunt the effect of an incoming missile attack. The first thing that you can do, if you can, is to have an anti-missile system. Now, the United States in the mid-1980s began working on SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, technology to shoot down incoming Soviet missiles, all right? The Israel, and we had a system which we deployed in Israel in 1990 and 91 during the first war over Kuwait, the first Gulf War, or actually the second Gulf War. That was called Patriot, and the Patriot missile was capable of taking out incoming Iraqi Scud missiles, and the Scud is a Russian design. Of course, Russia was, Soviet Union anyway, was almost no longer in existence at that point. Took out, they had a very high success rate, like for a piece of brand new technology, 30 or 40% of those missiles were taken out. Now, the Israelis have the Iron Dome system, and the Iron Dome system is basically an Israeli system. It is designed by Rafael Defense, an Israeli company. And I want to welcome Kevin Wade and ask him, Kevin, did you see the Iron Dome make any launches while you were over there?
I saw two launches in the last hours that I was there. There were, of course, many while I was there, but I saw two rockets go up probably 8:35 in the afternoon in the evening of last Thursday as I was leaving a TV studio heading to Ben-Gurion Airport. Now, I do not know, because I didn't get close enough to check serial numbers, I do not know whether those rockets were the Iron Dome in response to Hamas rocket attacks or they were the Hamas rockets themselves. But it was clear as day against the black night, basically torches rapidly rising from the ground, and I and the fellow I was sharing the car with both pulled over and put our faces in the dirt until we got an all clear indication.
Now, you and I, the Friday before last, were having a wonderful time at the Delaware State Fair, as you will recall. $6 lemonade and all. The next evening, Saturday, I was informed by our friend Denisini that you were basically packing and getting ready to go to Israel. And the day after that, on Sunday, you were on your way. And we haven't had a chance to speak, you and I, that much about what your trip was like when you arrived. So you got into the Ben-Gurion Airport approximately when? Was that Monday morning their time or when?
That was probably, let's call it, probably 9 o'clock in the morning their time. No, wait a
All
second.
Right.
Let's take that
and
back. Let's take that. But no, wait a second. Probably 3 o'clock in the afternoon their time.
Okay. Now,
there's about 11,
12
hours
point,
in the plane and then 7 hours in terms of a global time shift.
Sure, exactly. And at that point, I'm presuming you went to a hotel.
No, not at all. Arrived and the individual who was waiting for me said, would you like to meet some soldiers? And, of course, let me back up a second. My reason for going over is to gain a firsthand impression. As you and my close friends know, I've run a small business, especially engineering business, for over 30 years. We do work around the country. We've done work around the world. I find that reading emails or looking at PowerPoint summaries of progress is not the same as having your boots on the ground with the people doing the work to look in their faces, look in their eyes, hear the tone of their voice. That's how you know what's going on and how difficult are the challenges. So I've always been a person to get out of that air-conditioned office and be someplace with our team of people as they take on the most difficult challenges that our customers give to us in engineering. So when Israel finds itself under siege from Hamas rocket attacks, I could have watched reports from CNN or the BBC or Fox News, but again, I went back to what I've learned through many, many years, and that's to get my own boots on the ground. So I had a chance to get there quickly through some trusted friends, and that's what brought me to Ben Gurion Airport 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was met by someone who asked if I wanted to meet some soldiers, and of course, I went there to form an impression firsthand. I expected to meet some soldiers, some business leaders, some political leaders, to do a survey up close and personal of what life is like in this circumstance in Israel. And I truly expected to meet soldiers, but I expected to meet them 30 or 40 miles away from the action. And what happened is I was met at the airport. I was asked if I wanted to meet soldiers. I was taken through a variety of, call it, way stations and handlers. And I found myself at a forward assembly point some hours later in the dark at the Gaza frontier, surrounded by well, some of the best soldiers in the world of the Israeli Defense Forces.
So you were on the road for several hours at least, coming out of Tel Aviv and heading south towards Gaza.
Not that it's that long of a journey, but there's a series of way stations and handoffs and some other things that were happening at the same time. So it wasn't a direct trip. It was a series of relays zigzagging until we got close, and then we eventually got to the forward area in the sand and under an olive tree where IDF soldiers were preparing to go to the final forward point to go in on their missions.
And what was the impression that you had? Well, let me ask you this. The Israeli soldiers, what was their reaction to the fact that here is an American private citizen, a political candidate, but just an American coming over to see them and to see what was going on there? What was their reaction?
Their reaction surprised me. I felt fairly enough that I might be treated as a fifth wheel or as an intruder, and in the worst case, some American tourist. And I didn't want to be viewed in that way at all. And their reception was remarkable to me. They told me that they were honored that I was with them. And they shared their respect for what I was trying to do. And they very quickly began to open up and tell me their stories. Many speak English, others through a translator. And they had a profound respect for my visit, when in fact I felt that I was honoring them by going there, and in fact they felt that they could do me honor by receiving me. Now, none of this was sanctioned by the Israeli Defense Forces, the U.S. government, the Israeli government. This was simply a series of private transactions, most of which probably aren't permitted at all, that allowed me to be that far forward to develop this impression. And now let me talk to your audience a bit. I went there to develop a firsthand impression, and I came away with a lifelong engraving. And that is because of the resolute dedication that each and every IDF soldier has to defend his home and his family, and to see this very difficult combat through until its end. None of these soldiers, at the time I was speaking with them, wanted to see a ceasefire. They all wanted to see this operation through to its completion.
Well, as General MacArthur has said, in war, there is no substitute for victory. And as you and I have discussed, liberals like truces and ceasefires, conservatives like victory. And Israel has to establish victory over the Hamas terrorists, because Hamas terrorists, that is the group, the Hamas organization is the one that is running the people that live in the Gaza Strip now, the so-called Palestinians, they don't want to make Gaza into the garden spot of the Mediterranean, which, as you're aware, it easily could be if that's what they wanted to do with it. They just want to be at war with Israel.
You certainly know, maybe some of your listeners know, there has been an incredible amount of financial assistance sent to Gaza in the past 10 years. That financial support, that investment, that assistance could have turned Gaza into a modern-day Singapore, a crossroads of commerce. It could also be, because of its proximity and beautiful beaches on the Mediterranean, one of the world's top destination resorts, on a par with Monte Carlo. It could have made itself into a financial center for the world, much like Zurich. And instead, to my eyes, that money was redirected to building fighting positions, bunkers, tunnels, weapons manufacturing facilities, and to train the next generation of terrorists. And that's what the world needs to know has happened to the money from around the world that has gone into Gaza. I don't blame the people of Gaza. I blame Hamas, who has a chokehold on any aspirations of peace or prosperity that everyday people in Gaza may hold.
The tunnels are the means by which, when we hear of an Israeli soldier being kidnapped or Israeli civilians being kidnapped, as there were in June, which ultimately kind of, I think, served to kick this whole thing off, that is the means by which the Hamas terrorists are able to sneak into Israel and kidnap people or set up terror bombs or do the other things that they do. Now, the Israeli Defense Forces are finding the tunnels. Did you see any evidence? Occasionally we see something about high-tech Israeli equipment that is used to find the tunnels, or did you see any of the tunnels yourself?
I met with some specialty tunnel clearing units, or men from those units. The soldiers spoke candidly to me. I won't share the details of their candor because it's likely that they're going to be facing Hamas again very soon. Much of the tunnel clearing, just put it down to basics, comes to finding what appears to be out of place in a village or in a home, a room that has two refrigerators in. Where you find the entry hatch, and then you physically, and this is a tough and ugly job, those who specialize in clearing tunnels need to go down and clear that tunnel. The tunnels can be filled with Hamas terrorists. You may have a firefight below ground. Some of the tunnels are wired up with IEDs, booby traps, explosive devices to bring the tunnel down on Israeli soldiers when they're inside. There was a large casualty event for the IDF when I was there. I didn't talk about it in my tweets in detail because it had not been disclosed to the public yet, but IDF soldiers were clearing out a building, and one of their tasks is to remove all explosives as they go in to make it safe for more troops to come and do a more thorough search for documents and weapons. And apparently they failed to find all the explosives, and there were a number of IDF troops in the building and others who had found the entryway to a tunnel, who were also down in a tunnel, a large number of troops, when in fact the building and the tunnel was blown up, killing and injuring very many soldiers. Tough fighting, very tough fighting. Let me speak to your listeners. None of you have connecting tunnels between your house and a house 50 yards away. These homes, certainly in the front areas of Gaza, closest to the Israeli border, are equipped with tunnels that run from house to house to house. Some tunnels interconnect with other tunnels going into Israel. They go into Israel for some length, a remarkably long length. Some of these tunnels are deep underground, 20, 30 feet underground. Very sophisticated structures, concrete, lighting, ventilation, communication. And this is how the West's money has been used, not to develop Gaza as a commercial center or make a better life for Gazans, but to build a series of fortified bunkers disguised as homes. And I spoke to actually an American citizen from Chicago, 21, 22, 23 years old. He enlisted in the IDF 3 years ago. He's at a rank of sergeant now when he went in to combat operations. And when I met him, he had just been rotated back out for a brief spell with his remaining troops. Had only been back out of combat for a few hours when I met him, so everything was very fresh in his mind. 22 years old, he's a sergeant. He went in leading 2 7-man squads at the start of this military operation. When I met him, because of the casualties the IDF had taken, he was now the sergeant responsible for 40 IDF troops. He tells me that his friends back home in America, back home in Chicago, his age, are worried about their college exams. He says, I have other worries. And resolute, again, he wanted to get back in and finish up the job. And he spoke to me of clearing areas where they think the area is safe. They have cleared out. The combat has ceased. And 30, 45 minutes, 60 minutes later, out of two rat holes, pop some Hamas terrorists to catch the IDF soldiers in a crossfire. Very difficult fighting. Very much like what our U.S. Marines faced when they were in Fallujah. Very much like what U.S. Army faced in the Battle of Caen near Normandy in World War II. House-to-house fighting against a determined enemy. And again, we can have many differences with the state of Israel. We can have disagreements about tax treaties. We can have disagreement about intellectual property. We can have disagreements about access to visas. We can have disagreements about a shared foreign policy relative to Uruguay, for example. These are two sovereign nations, and they will have the differences that sovereign nations have from time to time. But when the question at hand is the survival of the state of Israel, when the problem at hand is the life of that nation, the United States needs to be the friend to Israel that Israel deserves. If we are to have friends, the friends we need around the world, we must be a friend to those around the world in their time of need. Israel has never asked for American boots on the ground. They have never asked Americans to fight their wars. But they do want America to be the friend it traditionally has been, and that's what's been lost under the leadership of President Barack Obama.
He's not really much of a leader. You had the opportunity to actually eat with the Israeli soldiers, and anyone that has ever been in the military, which would not include either one of us, Kevin, understands that being asked to eat with soldiers who are in the combat zone is a very, very honored thing. What was that meal like?
Probably 2-3 o'clock in the morning, we had just come back from the most forward position back to the assembly point, and a number of troops had come back, they'd come out of combat, they were coming back to get a meal, and a little fly tent, a little sun tent had been put up under an olive tree, and they had a field kitchen there, a very simple soldier's meal, soldier's rations in Israel. And of course, I wanted to get out of the way so these men could have the meal that they needed. And they asked me to join them. I told them, no, I'll wait till you're finished. I'll wait till you're finished. That's fine. I'll wait over here. You eat first. And they said, no, please join us at the table. Please join us at the table. We're honored to have you here.
Wow.
Mm. The following night, I was in a different area near the Gaza frontier with some soldiers who were just forming up to go in for combat operations. And one of the great traditions of the Israeli Defense Forces is to form in a circle. Your unit that's going into combat forms in a circle, and the senior-most person in that circle will read the soldier's prayer in Hebrew, and that's a very solemn and intimate occasion. It marks that transition from readiness to combat, and they asked me to join that circle, and that stays with me, my friend.
I would imagine it must have been an unbelievable experience, and of course I'm kicking myself because when you asked me on Saturday if I had a passport. You know, the answer was no. But in any event, I mean, the tunnels that they find, I've seen some video, and you have quite a few pictures posted on Twitter at KevinWade2014.
Yeah, Twitter at KevinWade2014. You know, I tried to do something of an on the spot series of Twitter feeds. Now, some are slightly out of sequence because of the location I was at. The last thing in your mind was going to Twitter. But as soon as I got more than a safe distance away and within some cell coverage where I could make a communication, I tried to pass on an accurate description of what I was seeing firsthand so that people back in the United States would have that same impression that I was forming and hopefully maybe that same engraving that I now carry. So at Twitter, at KevinWade2014, you'll see a whole series of tweets from Gaza or near Gaza just in the past few days. And if you go to our campaign website, wadeforussenate.com, wadeforussenate.com, you'll see a video of my being with the troops at within spitting distance of Gaza proper, right at the fence line. And I speak from the heart in that video, so I ask all of your listeners to go to wadeforussenate.com, take a look at the video, leave a comment in support for the IDF, leave a comment of prayers for the Israeli Defense Forces, leave a comment for me as a common-sense conservative running against, the man who self-describes himself as the most progressive senator in the U.S. Senate. So we have our work cut out for us. We have a position in the world to reestablish. We have borders to fix. We have an economy to mend, and we have great and deep divisions in this country that we have to heal. And that's what common sense conservatism is about, in contrast to a radical left wing ideology called liberal progressivism. I think many of your listeners are well aware of the litany of beliefs that associate with liberal progressivism, and we've got our work cut out. We have our work cut out, but we all stand together, shoulder to shoulder, and keep our eyes on the goal. We can get there, and we can save this country.
Kevin, I sure hope so. Are you going to be able to stay for a little while longer, or you have to run along? It's around 8:32. Eastern time.
I do need to run, but let me ask one more time. I'd like your listeners to go to Wade for www.wadeforussenate.com. Send a message. Volunteer if you can make the short drive from other places in the Mid-Atlantic to come into Delaware to help this campaign. And if you're financially able to, click that donate button. I promise you every single penny will be used to defeat the most progressive senator in the U.S. Senate. So I thank you, Duke, for the opportunity to share these stories of the IDF, pray for Israel, and I look forward to being with you again in the near future.
Thank you, Kevin. I'll be speaking to you soon, pal. Have a great night.
Thank you.
All righty. Kevin has been a particularly close friend of mine for the last 2.5, almost 3 years now, I guess. Absolutely about the greatest guy you ever met in your life. And, you know, I am just, I cannot express how truly disgusted I am when I hear Americans, particularly in places like Hollywood, talking about Israel as if Israel is the bad guy. Christian, if you want to give us a call, that would be terrific. I am going to take just a brief break right now. It is about 26 minutes before the top of the hour here on Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com, where America, in fact, always wins. One of the worst things that can happen to an American today, other than being put in the corner by a bunch of liberals, I guess. That would be my idea of H-E double hockey sticks on earth, I guess, is to be a victim of identity theft. You don't want it to happen. Just trust me. It's never happened to me. I've known some people that it has happened to, and you do not want to go there. Trust me. Don't let it happen to you. Protect yourself in advance. Sign up today with LifeLock. LifeLock is a lot more than just your standard credit monitoring service. LifeLock helps to protect your personal information. Using a combination of data surveillance techniques and outstanding member service, 24/7, 365, there's really nothing that comes close to LifeLock. So to protect your identity with LifeLock and get 10% off their great service, go to conservativenationmedia.com and click on the LifeLock banner. Network may not cover all transactions and the scope may vary. That's conservativenationmedia.com, then click on the LifeLock banner. You will be very glad you did. It's really about peace of mind, I guess. That's what we're talking about. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break right now. When I come back, doubtless we'll be joined by our international correspondent, Christian from Denmark. At the top of the hour, all kinds of interesting things are happening, so you stay right where you are.
Molon LeVay Challenge Coins and Wares. Similar to challenge coins used by various military units, these MLCCW coins are ideal for anyone that champions the right to keep and bear arms by highlighting the Second Amendment and the Greek phrase, Molon LeVay, which translated means, come and take them. Come check out our pro-freedom, pro-liberty, and pro-Second Amendment coins and shirts at MLCCW.com. That's MLCCW.com.
It's Thursday night, and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody, squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed... could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Hello, I am Robert Garding of the New Wives Conservatism radio show, heard on Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 Central, through conservativenationmedia.com. Being on the air since 2007 from behind the silver CNN microphone of freedom, we've helped people become more informed to keep socialists out of the White House and Congress. But that work isn't over yet. Tune in Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern on CNN for the New Wives Conservatism radio show, the voice of reason in our unreasonable world.
Aren't you glad the so-called fairness doctrine doesn't apply here? You're listening to Duke Books on conservativenationradio.org.
Yes, sir. That's about it. That Israeli thing for Kevin was pretty darn quick, and it happened very fast. You're in, you're out. Hello, goodbye. You know, I wish I had been over there with him. Although maybe it's not such a good idea because I would have wanted to actually do something to the Mohammedans. I'm not a big fan of theirs. Christian from Denmark, how you doing, buddy? Christian, you with us?
Yes, I'm here now. Just had to click on the icon. I'm here. I'm doing fine. Was a bit sick last week with pneumonia, but very on track now. So
good. Glad to hear
following
that.
Following the Israel conflict down there. Yeah.
And what is being said in Europe about the conflict between Gaza and Israel right now? What is the European press and maybe even more importantly, what are the European people that you know saying about this?
It's very diverted over here because you have the media and the media elite. They are almost like reading Hamas talking points. We had a very weird interview the other night on Danish TV, where we have our the journalists, of course, from the Danish TV Corporation, and then we had the foreign minister from a very liberal weak party, and he and the journalist was like he acted like he was a reporter from the you know the Hamas Weekly Standard or something, and the foreign minister, the Danish foreign minister, almost agreed with him. He kept on banging on about these so-called proclaimed innocent civilians that are lost on the Palestinian side, which I think it's really not the entire truth, because I think that many people forget is that Hamas has a very big backing among the people of Gaza. They have elections there where Hamas win big every time. So the civilians are not innocent. They are the ones that have voted them in. Just like, if you vote in a government that wants to increase your taxes, then you're not innocent when you all of a sudden have to pay a lot of tax in that country. That's the exact same way. So it's very distorted that way, because they always, bang on about these so-called so-called innocent civilians, which I always say, how do you know they're innocent? No one's asked that question.
Well, if somebody has a house and basically the bad guys come and they say, we're going to build a tunnel underneath your house, and the person in the house knows about it, that person is not an innocent civilian. I mean, unfortunately, in war, you are not going to have victory until you have eliminated the enemy's means, ability, and will to wage war. And when you've done that, then you have victory. And unless the Israelis do that, they're going to keep having to deal with this, these terror attacks.
Yeah, but it's the thing that I'm very much up in the debate over here is the Danish Jews, because the Jews in Denmark, by themselves doesn't really create any problems, because they are, they're very, like law-abiding and, hard-working people. But there is a big problem in Denmark, and I think that is, I could imagine it's the same or in the rest of the European country. The Jews over here are playing a very weird game, because they are very pro immigration. They are always, in the demonstrations, in the where they sign up for the Muslims should have their own mosque built here in Denmark. The top Jew people signed those petitions and are very active in the fight for Muslim rights in Denmark and Muslim rights, Muhammadan's rights to come and settle in Denmark. And you should think that it would be the other way around, because they know that the Muslims saved them. And the result is that the Jews, they can't walk around with, with the Star of David around, in the necklace or something, because then it would be hunted, if they just don't take it on and go to the mall. There would be some Muslim gangs of youth, attacking them, following them. So I'm not being, any way a Nazi or anything, but I like the Jewish people and I support them. I grew up watching Mel Brooks and Woody Allen. So I'm very pro-Jew, but they are playing a very weird game. And I think we should be, as a Christian people, should be aware of that. I'm not saying what we should do about it, and I'm not passing judgment in that way. I'm just saying they're playing a weird game, because on one hand, they are in war with the Muslims, and in another way, they are they are kind of attacking the European nationalists' rights, national citizens' rights to their own countries by fighting for more Muslim immigration in the European country. And that way they are danger to Europe, I think. And I'm writing a lot about that on Facebook and other places, you know, to get people to think about it and to get the Jews to choose sides, to stop, you know, like being pro-immigration when immigration really end up hurting themselves.
Well, it is hurting America.
Yeah.
It is hurting Europe. It is hurting every country in the world except the third world countries from which these people come.
Yeah.
And they, you know, the last thing in the world that a Western industrialized democracy like Denmark or America needs is a huge number of unskilled third world people that do not share our values, and your values and my
yeah.
values are Western European origin values.
Let's just say it like this. Yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, yeah, let's just say it like this. No country has ever benefited of gaining a Muslim population. No country has ever gone richer or gone more successful or more peaceful with the entry of big groups of Muslim people. That has just not happened in history, and that's something that you got to be much aware of. One thing I have, you know, about this whole Israel versus Palestine conflict, it always seems to me that there's always been a lot of talk about peace process, about, you know, negotiations, about ceasefire and stuff like that. I've always, you know, thought that was the wrong way to go about it, because basically there is a conflict. There are two people that both think they have the right for a piece of land. That's just the case. And historically, there are no other ways to handle this than to let them fight about it. And you know, I just say no negotiation, go fight. And it would be big and it would be bloody and it would be an awful mess. But I think that in the end, all would benefit from it, because either the Israel will disappear, and then the problems will in some way disappear, or else, which I hope will happen, the Muslims will just give up and accept the fact that they can't beat Israel and just accept Israel is there, and we have our own countries and just go about our lives that way. And I think that let them fight it out is really the only way. And then don't mingle and don't, you know, like
I think getting you're right
all,
about that. Yeah.
And don't get all gloomy and cheered eyes just because you see a lot of dead children in the hospital. Because, you know, if there were cameras around, I can certainly assure you that the First World War and all the other wars, there would have been tons of pictures just like that, just like the ones that they're feeding us every night at the news.
Sure.
You really can't trust
evidence, unquote, coming from Hamas. Christian, thank you for being with us tonight. I look forward to speaking with you again soon, my friend. Have a great evening in Denmark, and thank you for calling.
Same to you.
Thanks, pal. All righty. You are live on Radio Free America. Who's this?
Hello?
You're live on the air.
Yeah.
Who's this?
Oh, okay, great. I just tuned in. I caught the headline where you were going to be covering the end of World War II, and that's something of particular interest to me, so I thought I'd tune in, but I don't know if I missed it or I'm too early.
No. In about a little under 11 minutes, we're going to be going to Talk Radio News Service with Arthur Mondale at the top of the hour, a brief station break, and then John Parshall, the author of Shattered Sword, The Untold Story of the Battle of Midway, will be joining me, and we will be talking about Hiroshima and the end of World War II. What is your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Mike, and I'm calling from New York.
Oh, Mike, we've spoken before.
Yes, yep, I've called in before.
Yep, you're up there in the Hudson River Valley, north of New York City, near Newburgh. Right.
Yep, that's it. Exactly.
Okay. All right. And you in fact, I'm glad you called. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. You, in fact, are a military contractor for our DOD providing meals for the soldiers, correct?
And you've got an excellent memory. I'm very impressed. Yeah.
Well, thank
you. I'm also a collector of World War II militaria for over 40 years. So I specialize in German and Japanese war souvenirs for a long time.
Ooh.
I loaned items to several TV shows, and a lot of my stuff's in books, which I'm proud to say. I mean, they don't pay you for that. It's nice seeing what you've spent time studying and collecting end up being used for education. So that's payback, the way.
My dad had some World War II souvenirs, as he called them, that he got on Japanese-held islands in World War II. One of them was a scrapbook from a Japanese soldier, and this was probably on the island called Roy. He also had a hand grenade, no longer primed Japanese hand grenade, a Japanese bayonet. Now, the scrapbook, very interestingly, and let me tell you this story quickly, and then you can, make a comment. I had the scrapbook when I was a kid. Now that I'm no longer married, I no longer own the scrapbook, if you know what I mean. However, when I was about 13 or 14, at the swimming club that we were members of back then, there was a Japanese guy there named Kenji, and I think Kenji was probably in his mid to late 20s. He was a very nice guy, as most Japanese are. And I showed him the scrapbook, and he looked through it, and in the back there were many cartoons of the Japanese army, and these, I'm presuming, were made by the Japanese army for the amusement of their soldiers. And he read through several of them, and he was laughing so hard he could barely stop. And at one, because it's all in Japanese, and I was 12 or 13 at the time, and I said to him, "What's so funny?" And he looked at me for a moment, and he pointed to one soldier in a cartoon, and he said to me, "He is saying I must not cook my rice too much or it will burn." Now, that's not what was so funny. What was so funny was probably, you know, the other things that were being said, but since I was a young person, he didn't want to tell me presumably the dirty jokes that were, you know, going around this cartoon Japanese encampment. Have you ever seen anything like that?
Every country has always, they've always had magazines or cartoons that were directed, that were meant for morale for the soldiers of the country. I mean, Germany had them, America. I mean, the most famous, we know over here, Yank. Remember Yank magazine?
Oh, yeah, that was for enlisted men and by enlisted men, as opposed to Stars and Stripes, which was different.
Yeah.
That was an official publication.
But they even had a pinup girl on the back page of Yank magazine for the guys, and there were cartoons.
General Patton in the film, as George C. Scott, famously swiped off the wall of the barracks in North Africa.
Right. He was not a big fan of a lot of that. I mean, So that was common for them to have things like that, where they'd sit back and laugh at themselves, and it was all about morale. And I've got along those lines, I've got one book, it's a diary that someday I'd like to get translated, that was taken out of a cave, and it's all handwritten in Japanese. And you know, it's in a way the collectors end up being caretakers for forgotten history. And at least some of the stuff has been saved, because too many times I've heard of items like your dad's scrapbook that have been lost
because of family issues or moving or whatever. And then I hear of even more lately, thanks to our politically correct BS that we have out there, where people find grandpa or dad's Nazi flag that he brought home, and they freak out and throw it away. And there's no reason for it, but, oh, we don't want anyone to think that we're Nazis, do we? We must destroy this. It's a piece of history. Leave it alone. I mean, I was interviewed by the New York Times, and they came over and took a look at my collection. I told them our soldiers were not glorifying these criminals when they brought these items home. People are going to stand up, and they're going to define it for us. It's wrong.
It's disgusting. It's disgusting.
It really is.
Yeah. There is we have a drop on our network here, which certainly you have heard, in which the great voiceover professional Greg Duran says, "Hey, liberals, why don't you try rooting for your own damn country for a change?"
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way I see it. You know, the U.S. military is the greatest force for good that the world has ever known. And if you're going to beat the enemy, your fighting men in uniform, generally speaking, I think, have to have at least an emotional investment in the defeat of the enemy.
Yes.
And now, when we send our people into combat, it seems that the primary mission is to not offend the enemy's cultural sensitivity. And my reaction is, well, to hell with that. I mean, screw that. You know, if you're going to fight the enemy and beat him, you have to fight him and beat him.
I mean, but in World War II, it wasn't like that. I've got binders full of original propaganda leaflets and every type you can imagine, whether it's Japanese dropped on us, stuff we dropped on the Japanese, Russian-made dropped on the Germans, German propaganda leaflets dropped on the Russians. And you take a look at the depths, how in detail, how far we went to even demoralize the Japanese people. And it's very, very it's an interesting study to take a look at this stuff. And they're not politically correct whatsoever. A lot of them are not. But it's war. This wasn't a game. And luckily for us, the politicians were not involved to the extent that they have been today. Our guys had a job to do. They did it. See, the difference in World War II, when we pull up at the end of World War II, we'd pull up on a German town, and we'd have an advance. A patrol would come up on a town and occupied. The minute we drew fire, we'd pull back, we'd call in artillery or air, and flatten it. After we did this a few times, Burgermeister would come out. When we come up on the next town, they'd come out with a white flag and say, "Please don't destroy my town. There are snipers in that building, and there's a tank hiding over there." They learned their lesson. You see, Samara, Fallujah, Iraq, if we handled it the way we did World War II, it wouldn't have been maybe 15, 20 minutes to get the families and the kids out and flatten the town. You're not going to surrender? Flat. But politically correct today and letting the politicians run it? No. It'll never happen. They should have kept the media out of it.
That's right. If the same politicians that we have in Washington today had been in charge when Pearl Harbor broke out in 1941, today we would still be fighting in the Pacific. Hawaii would have changed hands 4 or 5 times. There would have been 15 or 20 ongoing peace conferences with Japan. It would simply have never, ever ended. You know, I am sort of reading Herbert Hoover's book called Freedom Betrayed, and I was curious, and we only have a moment or two here, Mike, but I was curious to see that he was talking about the fact that the demand for unconditional surrender may have prolonged the European and the Pacific War. But let me go ahead and take this break, Mike. Please hang on.
Okay.
We will be back in just a moment. Well, actually, a little bit longer than a moment. We've got Talk Radio News Service coming up with Arthur Mondale. I don't know if he's related to the former vice president or not. Brief station break. Mike and I will be back, and so will John Parshall calling in to talk about World War II. Stay where you are.
Coming to you every hour on the hour. The weather's fine, but there may be a meteor shower.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
From the Talk Radio News Service, I'm Arthur Mondale. The Obama administration has taken the next step into enacting regulations that will require federal contractors to disclose their payment data in an effort to achieve pay equality. The regulation put forward via executive order in April will now face a 90-day comment period before being enacted. Russian President Vladimir Putin has placed a ban on importing food from countries that have placed sanctions against his country, following Russia's hostilities in the Ukraine. Wednesday's decree did not specify which countries would be affected, but some economists already say Europe stands to lose the most from the decree, given its standing relationship with Russia. And the FTC said nearly 20,000 checks, totaling more than $16 million, are on the way to consumers who paid a company which falsely claimed it could reduce their tax debts. Under a settlement with the company American Tax Relief, the FTC acquired millions of dollars from frozen bank accounts. Talk Radio News Service, Arthur Mondale in Washington.
What does it take to be the leader in production systems technology? To be the one company that solves production problems at any plant, for any product, and with any technology? It takes a 30-year record of success. It takes total mastery of complex technologies with a history of delivering success every time, without fail. Only one company can claim that high ground in manufacturing line optimization, data automation, and systems integration, and that's Philadelphia Control Systems. In factories worldwide, Philadelphia Control Systems programs, software, and engineering solutions deliver optimal performance and output flow with a record that can't be matched. Any plant, any product, any technology. Philadelphia Control Systems, the leader in production automation since 1982. 800-335-9811, pcsforautomation.com. That's PCS, the number 4, automation.com.
Welcome back to The Cat Show. Up next, we have Nico. Nico is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right. A group known especially for their sunspot sleeping, ball chasing, leg rubbing, couch purring, bed leaping, and of course, companionship.
Wonderful. And what breed would you say Nico is?
I'd have to go with a tabbyish Persian kind of mix.
Tremendous cat.
I'd also like to point out her coat's wonderful mix of colors. Is it black, gray, gray-black, brown?
Somewhere in between.
Indeed.
You know, it's always special when we get to see a cat like this.
Just look how she struts.
It's like she owns the place.
And how she's so incredibly cute in her indifference to commands.
A strong-willed feline.
Ah, and see how she curls up and cuddles her person.
The pitch on her purring is simply perfect.
Nice one.
I know. Fantastic cat.
Fantastic indeed. But really the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Nico is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Alrighty, welcome back to hour number two of Radio Free America on ConservativeNationMedia.com, where America always wins. I hope that you recognized that piece of intro music there. That is the Warsaw Concerto, written by Richard Adensel for a British movie that came out during World War II, which, you know, I just have not been able to figure out exactly what it was called. I read somewhere that it was called Suicide Squad. I read somewhere else that it was called Dangerous Moonlight. But that has become kind of a modern, light classical, very iconic piece of music. We're joined again by our good friend Mike in New York State, who is doing his part to support our military's efforts. And Mike, I didn't know until recently that you are a collector of World War II memorabilia. In that war, my dad fought the Japanese, as you're aware, and my mom fought the Nazis. And my mom had a Nazi flag, which since I'm divorced now, I don't own anymore. However, John Parshall is calling, Mike, so how about if I put you back on hold? Is that all right with you? I'm presuming it is okay with Mike, but okay. Anyway, let me now welcome the author of the definitive book on the Battle of Midway and a very frequent guest expert on the History Channel and the Military Channel, John Parshall. How are you doing, John?
I am well. How are you, Duke?
I'm just fine, and I know you had a pretty potentially serious bicycle accident a while ago, but you're feeling better now from what I hear.
Yeah, I got doored on July 2nd, so today is actually the five-week anniversary of that accident to the day, and actually just got back from a bike ride with my wife, so I'm
wonderful.
Doing all right, getting around without a cane and riding the bike again, and yeah, I'm very happy that I didn't get chucked on my head or my neck or something like that. Can't complain.
Yeah,
didn't want a new hip, but there it is.
There you go. But you're playing the bass again, I'm sure.
Yes, I've been practicing the drums too.
Oh, fantastic. Well, today, on this day in 1945, for the very first time in human history, a nuclear warhead was used in combat. And I think everybody knows that Hiroshima was the target. And that was the beginning of the end of World War II, although there is a lot of thinking and speculation. I mean, it's impossible to say, well, if this had not happened, then that would have, or vice versa.
Yes.
Well, what are your thoughts about, you know, the mission of the Enola Gay under Paul Tibbets, the last surviving crew member, the navigator, Dutch van Kirk, passed away several days ago.
Yeah.
And now, expert view, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the real expert on the whole sequence of events here, obviously, is my friend Richard Frank, who wrote the book Downfall. So a lot of what you're going to hear tonight is probably based on, you know, many beer-side conversations that I've had with him over the years. We teach together for the Naval War College once or twice a year. I actually lived in Hiroshima right after my wife and I got married, so we were there for about a year, and even when I was there, when people would bring that topic up, you know, what do you think of the atomic bomb, I would tell them that I thought it was about the best thing that could have happened to Japan at that point. And I say that not to be mean or to be glib, and Duke, as you know, we don't necessarily share political leanings. You know, I'm a little to the left of you on the spectrum, but even having said that, I do believe that that statement is true. And the reason I believe it is true is because basically if you start doing the math on what the casualties were going to look like if we actually had to invade Japan, or even had the war just continued for another 3 or 4 months without an invasion, the body count that you end up with at the end of that time period vastly outweighs the civilian casualties that were killed at Hiroshima and then at Nagasaki. And you can do that math a number of different ways. I think one of the important points that Rich has made to me that I've always taken away is that the Japanese government at this time had made the decision to go forward with a defense of the Japanese home islands, knowing full well that continued resistance on their part was going to lead to mass starvation because we had destroyed their you know, internal infrastructure. They didn't really have the ability to distribute food. And so they were facing up to 7-digit casualties, you know, once the winter set in, and they, you know, knowingly were willing to sacrifice those civilians in the name of carrying the war on, which I basically find criminal. So
agreed.
Even a cursory examination, I think, of the Japanese casualties that would have accrued had the war carried on for another 3 or 4 months without the bomb leads one to the conclusion that, that dropping the bombs was the way to go. I think a lot of people out there sort of have this notion that there was some sort of a magic silver bullet that we should have been able to pull out of our pockets to compel the Japanese to surrender without having to drop those weapons. And I think we need to acknowledge that from a moral standpoint, you know, it's a horrible position to be in, that you are going to intentionally kill hundreds of thousands of civilians in that attack. It's an immoral thing to do. But I think we were faced with a spectrum of war termination options that ranged from god-awful and went down from there. And there
right.
really wasn't, you know, any magic silver bullet that was going to make this war end. So that's basically where I come down in a nutshell.
Yeah. I think you and I are, I mean, at the end of the day, if it was not the two atomic bombings that ended the war, those were, for the Japanese, the straws that broke that camel's back, even though there were utterly fanatic elements of the Japanese military that literally tried to stage a coup against His Majesty the Emperor when word had gotten out that His Majesty had decided that Japan, in his words, was going to endure the unendurable.
Yes.
And the His Majesty had made a... I mean, you can tell I respect the Japanese imperial family. And, you know, for some reason, I mean, you've been fascinated with the Japanese Navy since you were a very young guy.
Yeah.
And there is something very interesting about Japan. I can't quite put my finger on it, but...
It's a fascinating place.
Yeah. And
it's interesting, though. I actually don't have that much respect for the imperial family, and I personally think that Hirohito should have been hanged as a war criminal. But
MacArthur didn't think that, though.
Yeah, no, MacArthur didn't think that. And, you know, he had his reasons for not thinking that. I think a lot of things sort of got swept under the rug in the late 1940s as the communist threat began asserting itself, and, you know, we were willing to overlook a lot of things. But the result of that, I feel, is a sense of somewhat unwarranted victimhood on the part of the Japanese people, in that they were never really forced to seriously consider their actions during the war in the way that we rubbed the Germans' noses in things. And I'll give you an example of that. When my wife and I were newlyweds and we're in Hiroshima, and this was almost 25 years ago, so this is 1991, we went to the Peace Museum, and this was right before a big redo of the exhibits at the Peace Museum, but both Margaret and I were fairly taken aback when, after about 10 minutes at the museum, you walked in there and you're hit right away with, you know, pictures of, you know, frankly, roasted civilians and, you know, dark shadows on the sidewalk that were the shadows of people. And the whole tone of the exhibits was, on August 6th, 1945, the peaceful city of Hiroshima was suddenly attacked. There was no sense of context whatsoever. And that got a little bit better when they redid the museum, but I really, to this day, I do not think that the Japanese have had the level of serious self-examination to the degree that the Germans have. In fact, you'll hear a lot of people in Europe just basically say, okay, you know, the Germans have, you know, beaten themselves on their hair shirts for the last 60 years and enough, okay, we can move past this. You don't hear anybody in Asia saying that about the Japanese.
No.
Which is kind of sad. And we had the ability to do that. in the late 1940s, obviously, when we physically occupied Japan, and they were utterly prosperous.
Sure.
You know, we had the ability to do anything we wanted to in that society, but we, and when I say we, it's really, it came down to MacArthur's decision, you know, decided not to do that. And I think that that has had some deleterious downstream effects.
On December 15th, 2003, I went to the opening of the Dulles Airport wing of the National Air and Space Museum.
Okay.
And I don't know if you've ever been there.
No, I've wanted to, but yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you're an airplane buff like me, and I know that you are too, you would absolutely adore this place. It
right.
is wonderful. I don't know if it's quite as cool as the one on the Mall in Washington, but anyway, certainly the most famous airplane at the Dulles Wing or the Udvar Hazy Wing of Air and Space is the Enola Gay.
Sure.
So here it is. 2 days before the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers' flight, and Air and Space Museum has a history of opening on time, on budget, and the one on the Mall opened 2 days early on July 2nd, 1976, and this one opened 2 days early. It was supposed to open on the 17th, the anniversary of the Wright brothers, blah, blah, blah. So anyway...
Yeah.
There are hundreds, more than that. There was probably 2,000 people standing in line to get into the Air and Space Museum at Dulles. And we all got inside, and we're all walking around, and just I had gone by myself with my camera. That was it. Suddenly, I hear voices raised, and I hear people yelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I see Smithsonian guards in uniform. They are running to various places. I see cameramen from TV stations that are running. And there was a group of 8 or 10 Americans who were protesting the presence of the Enola Gay. One of them had a large container filled with red liquid, which he threw onto the Enola Gay,
right?
Which I thought was, you know, you can think what you want, but that was a desecration. And there were dozens of Japanese reporters there.
Sure.
And Japan, culturally, they are in denial of their role in World War II. I mean, you know, there is such a thing as the rape of Nanking.
Right.
This is not anti-Japanese, bigoted, racist, Yankee stereotype. This is documented, what they did in the Chinese city of Nanking.
Although
in
there's 1934. A sizable contingent of Japanese people who do not believe in the facts as presented regarding atrocities there.
Well, yeah.
And
there's a large number of people that don't believe in the Holocaust either.
Sure. Right.
You know, facts are facts. But I was, you know, I tried to engage a couple of the Japanese in conversation. A few of them spoke English, and the one or two that I did meet that did speak English, they just basically wanted to condemn the Enola Gay. And one of them said to me, "How could you put this death machine on display like this? It should have been destroyed."
Sure.
Now, here's a scenario. Here's a scenario. Let's imagine it is July of 1945 at Alamogordo. Oppenheimer and his friends are not able to get the fusion warhead or the implosion warhead to detonate.
Yeah.
And they then begin thinking that the shotgun warhead or the little boy warhead, that one might not work as well.
Right.
And we can't really fly over Japan and drop it because if it doesn't work.
Sure.
You know, I mean, there are just too many downsides to, you know, trying a weapon like that, actually using it and having it not work.
Right.
What would have been our next move at that point if ultimately it turns out we don't have the nuclear weapon. What do
right.
we do now?
Right. Well, as you're probably aware, there was, you know, plans to physically invade Japan, starting with an invasion of the southern island of Kyushu, which was Operation
right.
Olympic, and then followed up in 1946 with an invasion of the Kanto Plain around Tokyo, which was Operation Coronet. And
mm-hmm.
Olympic is scheduled to go down on November 1st. And so now you've got five-month window where we're going to be building up forces. The problem is that by July of 1945, a lot of people in military intelligence are starting to get very concerned that Operation Olympic is going to be a bloodbath, because the original specifications for that operation were, the assumption was that the Japanese were only going to be able to put 6 divisions into Kyushu, and maybe during the course of the invasion would move another half dozen or something like that. Well, by July, they're noticing that there are already 10 Japanese divisions down there that they had counted, and there were in actuality 14 in Kyushu, which means that our invasion force of roughly a dozen divisions is now going to be facing the Japanese on a 1-to-1 ratio, which is not the recipe for success, in the words of MacArthur's intelligence chief.
Right.
I don't know how things would have turned out. Nobody can give you a definitive answer on that. I think that from a qualitative standpoint, you know, a U.S. infantry division and certainly our Marine divisions were qualitatively much better than your standard Japanese infantry division, certainly in terms of firepower. And so I can't help but think that given the amount of firepower that we were bringing to the fight, and certainly the air power. The reason we're invading Kyushu is because we can actually stage long-range fighters from Okinawa to command the invasion beaches. But the Japanese had thousands of kamikazes stored away, and their plan was explicitly to launch as many of those as they could, as soon as they could, and not to go for our high-value targets like carriers and battleships, but to go for the invasion transports, which were much less defensible, and to try to kill as many servicemen as they could before they could even hit the beaches. I think it's a bloodbath. Even if we get ashore credibly, it's just going to be horrendous. And the other thing we have to take into account, too, is if you roll back to the invasion of Okinawa, you had ended up with between a third and a half of the civilian population on Okinawa had been killed, the majority of them by their own troops. So the civilian casualties...
Or they had killed themselves.
Yes.
In many cases
under compulsion. You're trapped in a cave with a bunch of desperate Japanese soldiers who are going to kill themselves, and they make you kill yourself, too. It was just hideous beyond belief.
It's incomprehensible.
Yeah, it is really incomprehensible. So I think Olympic is going to be terrible. I think it's going to be very heavy casualties. And there were people inside the U.S. Navy, Nimitz and King, were both beginning to have serious misgivings about whether or not the operation could even go forward. And so, who knows what ends up happening then. They might have decided to hit northern Kyushu and sacrifice the air power from Okinawa, or maybe you go directly for Tokyo. I don't know. But there was a lot of consternation in July 1945 in the upper command circles about whether or not this was a wise operation. So meanwhile, the clock is now ticking. If you presume that the bombs don't get dropped in early August, we've got, 3 months of time between the bombings and when Olympic is supposed to go down. During that time, you have Japanese civilian casualties, which are, I can't give you a monthly figure, but it's a very high number because we are firebombing their cities and inflicting enormous damage on them. The other thing that I think gets lost, too, is what's happening in China during this time, that the Chinese claim, and most of the statistics I've read said that during the course of the 8-year war there, they lost between 17 and 22 million civilian casualties, which says that, to put it in crude terms, they're losing about 200,000 civilians a month. So there's, you know, pick your number, 500,000, 600,000 dead Chinese in that 3-month window of time. And the Chinese are our allies in this war, you know. So again, if we're doing the calculus on which is the more moral outcome to this war, you know, I just have to say that the atomic bombings were give you the lowest body count in terms of civilians, and certainly in terms of U.S. servicemen. You know, again, that was the way to go. I can understand why people get upset about the Enola Gay. I mean, again, we have to be candid about the moral aspect of intentionally targeting civilians. And obviously we have been doing this, you know, for years during the bombing campaign in Germany and then later during Japan. It's a very queasy moral ground to be walking on, that you're going to, you know, intentionally kill these people to bring about the end of the war. But as Rich Frank said to me once, he's like, well, you know, again, given an array of horrible possibilities, pick the lesser sin and sin boldly. And I think that's kind of where we're at.
That sounds like a very, very interesting. Of course, I've seen Mr. Frank on quite a few of the same programs on which you have appeared. He seems like a particularly knowledgeable guy, as are you.
Yeah, very knowledgeable.
I once heard someone say that the single biggest moral failing of which the U.S. or the United Nations, which is what the Allies called themselves during World War II, the United Nations, could have possibly engaged in would have been to lose that war.
Yep.
And we just couldn't do that. We could not allow that to happen. It wasn't a question of two equally ruthless dictatorial societies just trying to see who was going to hold the most territory. I mean, we went into that largely for moral reasons. I think the U.S. is probably the only country in the world that has ever gone to war to end slavery, which we did. And, you know, as you mentioned, China was our ally, and Japan, starting in 1931, had invaded the region of China known as Manchuria, and then they went from there. And the reason that President Roosevelt moved the Pacific Fleet from San Diego to Pearl Harbor was to basically send a signal to the Japanese that, look, you know, we've cut off your oil, we have cut off your supplies of raw materials, we don't want to have to do anything beyond that, but if we do, we will, you know. And Japan, of course, they completely misunderstood what America was all about at that stage in our history. If not for, you know, at least the legendary story of the poor typist at the Japanese embassy in World War II on that Sunday morning, who knows what would have happened differently. But that's a, you know, Olympic and coronet and downfall would have been, that would have been without a question the worst military invasion and operation in the history of mankind. I mean, everything else would have paled compared to that.
Yeah, the estimates for casualties are you know, all over the map. But any way you slice that, I think, you end up with millions of casualties, just military casualties. You know, again, who knows with the civilians? And I should make it very clear that, you know, I'm talking about the math as far as civilian casualties concerned. I don't think that was uppermost in Truman's mind at all when he was making this decision. I think his calculus was certainly based almost solely around how can I possibly get my way out of this thing with the lowest expenditure of American servicemen's lives, which is a perfectly reasonable viewpoint for Truman to take. That's where his main concern
Absolutely.
Should have been. And another point that gets raised by a lot of people is, well, you know, had we just been willing to secure the position of the emperor, you know, the Japanese might have caved a little bit sooner if we had made public the fact that that we were willing to preserve him on the throne. And I guess my counterpoint to that is we were under no obligations to preserve anybody. I mean, we had gone to war to destroy Nazi Germany and to destroy Imperial Japan. And we, once democracies have made up their minds to go to war, this is a point that was made by H.P. Wilmot, a historian I'm very fond of, he's like, it's really hard to get democracies into a war in the first place, and once you do so, they tend to fight for absolute sorts of outcomes. And that's exactly what we had here. You know, we were under no obligation to do anything to accommodate the Japanese or to accommodate the emperor. The only thing we were trying to do was end up with a political outcome that satisfied us, and the only outcome that was going to satisfy us after 4 years of savage warfare was, you know, peace on our terms. So, you know, that's basically my response to people that say, well, we should have, you know, been a little more lenient in terms of broadcasting what flexibility we had in terms of the Potsdam Declaration. And it's like, well, you know, the Japanese needed to be a little bit more flexible on these things as well, at least in my opinion.
I have recently begun reading Herbert Hoover's book, Magnum Opus. It's a tome. It's unbelievable. It's just incredibly dense. It's called Freedom Betrayed. You've maybe heard of it or perhaps seen it.
Haven't,
One
actually.
Of the interesting things... Okay, all right. Well, if you get a chance, I mean, people can say what they want about President Hubert, Herbert Hoover, who was president when the Depression started.
Right.
That's why he wasn't president any longer.
Sure.
But he was a brilliant individual. And one of the things he writes about in this book is the idea that if we had not demanded unconditional surrender of Germany and of Japan, the war might have ended earlier with fewer casualties. But I would mention that that is how World War I ended. Germany did not unconditionally surrender. They agreed to stop aggressive war. They retreated to within their own borders. And because World War I ended essentially in a truce, we directly got World War II as a
yeah.
direct result of that end condition.
No, and I
so
think
there
that's,
are some...
Yeah, that's a perfectly fair analysis, and I think that that explains in a nutshell why it is that we began demanding unconditional surrender you know, at the Casablanca Conference in early 1943. It's interesting you should raise that because I just was reading the official German war history, and they talk about the issue of unconditional surrender, and basically the German opinion on this matter is that it's unknowable whether or not it would have made things any different because, you know, the bottom line is that Hitler was the guy who was calling the shots, and he was not a rational individual on a number of...
No, he was not.
Yeah.
No, he was a nut job.
He was yeah, so, you know, presenting someone like Hitler with a position of more flexibility, I don't know what you get, but my guess is you don't get any quicker conclusion to the war. Among other things, one of the things that the German history makes very clear is that there were peace feelers that were put out from the Russians to the Germans in the winter of 1942, and indeed the Japanese were offering to mediate the conflict between Germany and Russia. But this just it was completely irreconcilable with Hitler's mindset. I mean, in his viewpoint, the entire purpose of his having gone to war in the first place was the annihilation of the Bolshevik state. And so, you know, there was no point in doing anything other than fighting that war down to the last bloody dribble. And indeed, in 1943, he made the statement that, you know, this was the final struggle for Germany, and that if Germany was not worthy of this struggle, then she deserved to be destroyed along, you know, with her entire population. So, you know, not a good guy to have to negotiate with. And, you know, the other thing I think I'd – go ahead.
Well, I was going to mention that ultimately it was that same Russian general that defeated Napoleon, that defeated Hitler, General Winter.
Right.
That's, you know, as Bernard Law Montgomery, who famously spoke in twos, once said, there are two rules to warfare, only two rules. Never invade Russia, never invade China, never invade Russia or China.
Yeah.
Apparently that's the way the guy spoke.
Right.
And you really can't invade Russia. You just, you know, it's just, it's almost like invading Switzerland. What are you going to do? You know, you can't do anything about it.
Yeah, I actually, the winter, and we're just, man, we're going all over the place tonight, aren't we? I personally don't think that it was the winter that saved the Soviet Union during 1941-42. I believe that really it's a multifaceted answer, but really the thing that saved them is their incredible ability to mobilize and to put divisions into the field, albeit incredibly crappily trained, ill-prepared divisions, but just to be able to mobilize the amount of manpower that they did. You look at the American war effort and, you know, we put 91 divisions in the field in the course of the war. The Russians raised more than 400 in, you know, just in the first 2 years. So if the Russians had not had the ability to play that trump card, they don't even make it to the winter. And even with their ability to do that, they still lost 6 million casualties in the first 6 months. You know, or 4 million military. It's just jaw-dropping. So, yes, was the winter a factor? Yeah, absolutely. Part of what's going on there, though, from the German standpoint, is that there was a very intentional decision on the part of the Germans that as the campaign, the initial 1941 campaign, wound on into October and November, and they are preparing to make, you know, their final lunge towards Moscow, the quartermasters very explicitly came to them and said, look, you know, here's the amount of railroad tonnage we've got. This is how many tons we can move. You can have one of two things. I can send you ammunition and fuel, or I can send you winter clothing and other and you know, quartermaster materials to start building winter quarters. Which do you want? And the generals, well, you know, we got to have bullets and oil, you know, bullets and gas to make it to Moscow. So, well, give me that. So it wasn't like, you know, they got caught out unprepared. There were certainly people within the German military that had an understanding of what was going to happen if the war, you know, lasted into November and December. You know, those clothes are all sitting back in the warehouses in Germany, and there's nothing you can do about it. So anyway, kind of got far afield there, but yeah, there's a lot of things going on in the Soviet Union besides just cold weather.
Sure. When the subject is World War II, at least with me, I mean, I'm always interested in talking about everything about it. But getting back to Japan,
yeah.
When you and Mrs. Parshall were newlyweds and you lived there, were you able to get any Japanese to say a bad word about General Douglas MacArthur?
I never went to that subject directly.
Okay.
But, no, it's pretty tough to get anybody to say anything bad about MacArthur. And I got to say, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of MacArthur as a military commander. And this is mostly based on the context of the fact that I'm writing a book about 1942, and I think his generalship in 1942 is just horrid. I think he was...
I would agree.
Yeah, it was just, it was wretched. He certainly did some very innovative and useful things later on in the war. His campaign, once you get past Buna in New Guinea, you know, 1943 and 44 were good years for MacArthur. I think he was a very moral, supreme commander of the occupation forces. I mean, I would point out that it was due to MacArthur that, you know, the Japanese did not starve during the winter of 45 to 46, and that he was very, very vocal in demanding that the Americans, you know, move as much food aid into the Japanese home islands during that time period as we could to head off mass starvation. So, not a big MacArthur fan, but I do think that he basically did right by the Japanese people by and large.
I once saw a Japanese guy on TV, and it might have been one of the shows on which you have appeared, you know, somewhere on History Channel or the Military Channel or something.
Right.
And he said that they saw posters that had gone up in both languages all over Japan in 45 and I would presume into early 46 that said that any American soldier who is caught slapping or otherwise abusing any Japanese will be court-martialed.
Yeah.
And this Japanese guy said, we saw those posters and we knew at that moment that we had been absolutely beaten because they understood that on a psychological, and that's why it was put up in, one of the reasons it was put up in both languages. One of the other incidents in Tokyo during the occupation that involved General MacArthur was this, and you're probably familiar with this. They were in the office building. General MacArthur and his staff were in the office building that they used for their headquarters. And they were riding up in the elevator to the general's office, which was, if I remember, this is from American Caesar by William Manchester. Yep,
yeah.
Top floor, you bet. And the elevator stopped on an intermediate floor, and a Japanese electrician went to walk onto the elevator. And he looked up and he saw it was General MacArthur, and he immediately assumed what the Japanese call the low posture, that deep bow that they do. And he went to back out of the elevator, and General MacArthur took him by the arm and said through his translator, no, you ride up with us. There is not enough electricity available to make a separate trip. Well, the word of this got around. A poster of the event had been made. People began writing about it and talking about it. A play was written and performed about this event. And MacArthur apparently understood what he referred to as the Oriental mind to a very large extent. He was wrong about some things, obviously. He was wrong about whether China would come to the aid of North Korea and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
But I think way down deep inside, he actually liked the Japanese people, and I know that he loved the Filipino people.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was – that guy held more power than any American in history. He had absolute power in Japan.
Yeah.
And even Truman really wasn't going to mess with him, you know, until Truman figured he had to, you know.
Well, and because MacArthur was being, you know, utterly insubordinate and was basically trying to dictate what American foreign policy should be, and that's definitely outside his purview.
Yes, but that's something you're not allowed to do, yeah.
No,
now, have you been to the Museum of the U.S. Air Force in Ohio? You're from the upper Midwest. I don't know if you've made
went there
to
several
Ohio
times
right
as a
now.
School kid. It's been, you know, a long time since I've been there.
That is where Boxcar, the Nagasaki B-29, is located.
Yep.
And I was just wondering if you had seen it.
I undoubtedly did.
And that raises
an interesting point. Here I have been saying, well, you know, the atomic bombings were the best thing we could have done for the Japanese. I disagree with the rapidity with which we hit Nagasaki. I think that if you know anything about Japanese culture and you understand that it's a very slow-moving, consensus-based, decision-making kind of culture, there's absolutely no way that the Japanese government was going to be able to come to any sort of a decision to terminate the war in the span of 3 days. And so, to my mind, hitting Nagasaki just 3 days after Hiroshima was irresponsible at best and potentially criminal. We needed to give them a week. We needed to give them 10 days. We weren't going anywhere in the next 3 months anyway. We certainly had, some time on our side. But again, against the backdrop of the civilian casualties that we're talking about, I mean, you hate to say it, but it's a quibble. I'm quibbling over 90,000 dead people, but there it is.
When I lived in Syracuse in the early 1980s, I met a lovely Japanese American girl, and her parents owned a couple of Japanese restaurants in town.
Mm-hmm.
And Noreen and I started going out, and she was very nice and, like many Japanese girls, very pretty. And I met her parents, and I knew them well. I knew the whole family. And her mom was from Hiroshima, and her dad had been an American soldier during the occupation. Excuse me. And I asked Noreen's mom, Mrs. Lukacik, what it was like on that morning in Hiroshima. And I was surprised how sort of not quite matter-of-fact about it she was, but how animated was the way in which she told the story. And she was going to school somewhere, I guess, in the suburbs, and they were outside of town. And she said when Mr. B came over, that's what they call the B-29, B-San.
Mm-hmm, B-San, yep.
The alarm was sounded, and the procedure was for everybody to leave the school building because that was just what they thought was the safest thing for the kids, I guess.
Right.
And she said they were all outside, and she said the first thought that she had was, for some reason, the Americans are taking our picture.
Mm-hmm.
She thought it was like a flashbulb.
Yeah.
And, the bright flash of a nuclear warhead going off is brighter than the sun for an instant. And she said, of course, a moment later, we saw all this fire, and then the wind started. And, she was getting very animated about it, and she wasn't mad or angry or anything like that. But, I am very, very glad that I actually met someone who was an eyewitness to that incredibly important watershed event in modern human history.
Yeah.
You must have met some people when you were living in Hiroshima that saw it as well.
I'm trying to remember at this point if I did or not. I honestly can't recall. There were certainly people that were there who had been there during the war, and actually one of the things that really made an impression upon Margaret and myself was just the number of old women who were walking around bent over double with osteoporosis. And
sure,
the reason for that was because, again, they had not been getting adequate nutrition during the war years. So there's another indication of why it was so important to get this war over with as rapidly as possible. I mean, you know, the malnutrition in Japanese society was already rampant, and it was gonna, you know, it was gonna edge up into outright starvation very, very quickly. You know, there wasn't a lot of time to head this off.
Noreen's mom told me that her brother had been an American prisoner of war, and he was in the United States. I think she indicated that he was in New Mexico or Arizona or something like that. And she said when he came back to Japan after the war, and I'm presuming it would have been at some point in early 46 maybe, she said she was, her whole family was shocked and stunned by the fact that he was obviously fit, he was obviously well-fed, he had no diseases or anything, and he told them that his treatment as a POW in America, in terms of food and just, you know, humanity, had been better than the way he had been treated in the Japanese army when he was in, you know, and I've heard this from many Germans as well. In here on the Eastern Shore, and I live on the Delmarva Peninsula, which is the landmass that separates the Chesapeake Bay from the Atlantic Ocean, on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, there's a town called Princess Anne. And during World War II, Princess Anne was a German POW location.
Right.
And I have met many people from Princess Anne who have said every single German that was here during the war as a prisoner, after the war, came back to visit the friends that they had made.
Right.
You know, there are many people today, if you listen to certain quarters and to certain people, that attempt to portray America as a ruthless, heartless, cruel nation of blood-soaked war criminals and that sort of thing. And I got to be honest with you, our history, other than Andersonville and Elmira, because that was different, our actual history just does not verify that. It just doesn't.
No, I absolutely concur with that. You know, that is not to say that, you know, there were not isolated incidents and war crimes, and, you know, it was an awful fight. And certainly during the occupation, there were, you know, the reasons those posters that you mentioned earlier went up regarding, you know, servicemen mistreating Japanese women and so forth, you know, because things like that happen when you have large groups of soldiers in a civilian population. But I think the difference is whether or not those isolated incidents are a part of an actually, you know, an intentionally thought out campaign. That was the difference. You know, that certainly we did not go into Japan with the notion that we were going to oppress the civilian population and commit mass rape and so forth and so on. Whereas if you look at Japanese occupation, you know, well, China is just beastly. And then you go to even places like, you know, Singapore. Within the first month of the Japanese occupation of Singapore, you've got the Suk Ching massacre, which results in I forget how many tens of thousands of Chinese, ethnic Chinese were shot on various beaches around Singapore. But, you know, the Japanese were just ruthless about that kind of stuff, which, you know, again, these facts are not lost on the people of in the Asian mainland, even to this day. And I do think that the Chinese government and also the Korean government, South Korean government, they intentionally fan the flames of nationalism and make out the Japanese to be the bad guys in order to you know, incite domestic opinion to get domestic agenda items passed and so forth to take attention off of themselves. With that said, there's just no question that the Japanese occupation during the war of any country that they were in, they were awful. So, no, I don't think from a moral standpoint there's any comparison between our occupation and theirs.
I have many Korean friends from my days in commercial real estate. One of them, Sylvia, you know, the Koreans in America are, they work so hard and they are so focused on their businesses and on their children's education, and, you know, they've been wonderful people to me.
Yeah.
Sylvia told me her aunt had been a comfort woman.
Yeah.
That the Japanese, you know, abused in a horrible way. And there were some Korean women who sued a few years ago.
Oh, they'll never get satisfaction out of the Japanese from that. There's,
oh, no.
You know, that's,
no, the,
that's
no, the
never
Japanese
gonna happen
court
in a million
was like,
years.
Well, yeah. Yeah, the Japanese court basically said, you know, we don't know what you're complaining about. You got your money.
Right.
That's the only, you know, it's just unbelievable.
Well,
now, how often
a lot of what's going on there, too, is just I hate to say this, but a lot of the Asian ethnicities really don't like each other very much. You know, there's a lot of racism that goes on there. It was really eye-opening for me as an American to go overseas. And we obviously have some difficulties in this country with how we have dealt with race relations over the years. And yet you go to a place like Japan, and you realize that actually we deal with immigration and different ethnicities far better than anybody in Asia. If the Japanese were subjected to the same level of immigration into Japan that we deal with here in the U.S., their society would collapse. That's my opinion. The other interesting thing, you know, as far as the Koreans are concerned, well, I remember very clearly watching the Korean customs officials just ripping apart the luggage of all of the Japanese people who came off the ferry when we went from Shimonoseki over to Busan to get our the visas changed. So, yeah, the Koreans bear no love for the Japanese. And at the same time, if you look at the Peace Park Museum in Japan, I forget what the exact statistics are, but I believe that of the civilians that were killed in Hiroshima, you're talking 80,000 people or something like that, 10,000 of those were Koreans who were, you know, working or were slave labor or whatever. The Japanese, at least when we were there in the early 90s, have never allowed a memorial to the Korean war dead to be built on Peace Park grounds. There is a memorial to the Korean dead, but it's stuffed in this crappy little neighborhood down by the docks. So, you know, again, there's a fair amount of denial going on there, I think, about who were the victims. You know, not, there were more than just Japanese victims. You know, what was really going on there? And you know, they, again, I just don't really feel that they've ever been able to come to terms with that.
On one occasion, my friend Noreen and I were walking somewhere, and I forget whether it was in Syracuse or in New York City, and we passed some other Oriental people that, as we walked past them, Noreen got a very sort of dark look on her face, and her mother was Japanese, but her father was American. And then she made kind of a scowl as we got past them. And I said, you know, what's up with that? And she said, they're Korean. Ugh.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, we got that in the 90s, too.
This is in America,
you know, why would you want to go to Korea?
80s.
You know, it's stinky over there, you know. And
yeah.
It's like, wow, guys, really? We're still here?
I know.
Yeah.
Well, John, thank you so much for being with me tonight, and I am always honored to have you on the air, and I certainly look forward to your – we only have a few seconds left, but Please keep me posted on your progress on your book about the year 1942. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a few more years, so yeah, hang on.
I'll wait.
All right.
Thank you, my friend.
Take care.
Thank you. Have a great night, sir. All righty, that will just about do it for this episode of Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com. Thanks so much for being with us. Watch my Facebook page, Duke Crooks. More will be revealed.